So without further ado, Laurent, thank you.
Thank you, Michael. First I would like to thank Michael again, Paul, and the other organizers of this workshop for allowing me to give this talk in this very nice workshop. It's good that Michael gave his presentation before me. In some sense, what you're going to see in the next 40 minutes or so is the other side of what Michael has presented, what is under the hood, if you want. You may have noticed that this talk shares a common feature with Guillermo's talk yesterday. It's written in LaTeX, which you may take as a bad sign. And it's also the only feature that this talk shares with Guillermo's talk, which is you may take as another bad sign. What I want to talk about is this series of equations that we progressively started to build probably 10 years ago, when we started to decide that it would be a good idea to start really using the Riemannian structure on diffeomorphisms and shape space that we had already started to use for computing metrics and doing mapping, to use the other features that come with the structure, including geodesics and, as we'll see, parallel translation. So I want to go progressively survey this how this basic features in Riemannian spaces translate when you're dealing with spaces that are groups of diffeomorphism, which or in infinite dimensional spaces, and I will try to go progressively from, say, the most simple somehow equations, at least conceptually, to maybe those that are a little more complicated. Just have more lines in them. This is just a short list of collaborators that were directly involved in what I'm going to present today. There are more, but this is just regarding the talk. So before just going into the equations, I want to start with the structure itself on which we will be working, and so it's how to build a Riemannian metric on groups of diffeomorphisms. So let's walk a little bit through this. Just to start with, this is the notation. We work in some open subset in D dimensions. The definition of diffeomorphism is that it's a smooth map which is invertible with a smooth inverse, and they form the diffeomorphisms form a group for the composition of functions. The diffeomorphisms are important to us, not really as such, but in the way they deform other objects. So I will talk a lot about actions here, and diffeomorphisms act on a whole variety of objects, including points, function densities, which are the three main examples I will discuss here. We've seen in Michael's talk that this action could be defined for vector fields, for frames, for symmetric matrices, this is why we like the action that the Alexander and G action that we used. It's just because it's an action, and it's a group action, and so that makes us happy somehow. So here is the notation for an action. I will just use a dot every time a diffeomorphism acts on something. I will use a dot between them. This is the mathematical definition of a left action, and everything that is acting upon diffeomorphism, I will call them deformable objects, which is quite natural. Here are the examples for the three type of objects I want to consider today. It's for points. Well, if you have a collection of points, then a diffeomorphism just moves each of the points. And if you have images, this is the action on images. If you want to play a little bit with densities, the natural action is that one with the Jacobian determinant coming for the change of variables in densities. Reading again to Michael's talk, there's a nice way to build diffeomorphism, a constructive way to do it, which is by using flows associated to differential equations. So if you're given a vector field that may depend on time, you can consider the ODE on omega dy dt, or dty as the notation I will be using in that talk, equals v of ty. So this is an ordinary differential equation that would have solutions under the usual conditions on the vector field. And this solution would not leave omega if they start within omega if you get, again, natural boundary conditions on V. What's important here is that if you define phi of tx to be the solution at time t of this equation, when you start it with x at time 0, you get, when you fix t, a diffeomorphism. And so this is a nice way to build diffeomorphisms as time-dependent solution of differential equations. Its main importance is to simply pull back the construction effort, not directly on phi, but on v. And so in the next slide is now what kind of structure we want to impose on the vector field that we will use to build diffeomorphisms. And these vector fields will be assumed to belong to a nice space, space V in that slide, which will be assumed to be a Hilbert space, and we will be assumed to have nice inclusion properties in set of smooth functions, at least C1 for most of the cases we're going to consider. So here's the notation. We have a Hilbert space of vector fields on omega, and so this Hilbert space has a dot product, which is denoted with a V subscript, and the dot product is, we're going to assume that it's associated to some operator. So the norm of V squared is integral of omega of LV transpose V dx. I have a disclaimer just below that, because our life would be too easy if it was just that, maybe not as fun. This has to be understood in a generalized sense. The LV here is in many interesting cases, a singular object. This is what Michael has called the momentum. And you've seen the example that the momentum was restricted to the boundary of the shapes in case of binary shapes. In that case, it was, in fact, from a mathematical point of view, it was a measure supported by the boundary of the shape. And so it can be a singular object. More interesting than L itself is its inverse, because its inverse is, on the other hand, very nice. It's a kernel operator. And it might be the most important part that we have to model when we build the algorithms. And so it's this just say that K is a kernel operator, and this is what we use most of the time in practice, maybe equally with the kernel which corresponds to the Laplacian operator L, with some power of the Laplace. So remember that the kernel will be in most of the formula. So it's here, and it's a nice thing. It's just that. Okay, so once that we have fixed this structure, the set V, the Hilbert space V on vector fields, now we can go back to our construction of vector fields using ODEs, and build a Riemannian structure on the set of diffeomorphisms. And an equivalent point of view is to say that you build you consider V to be the set of to provide small variation of the identity. So you identify somehow V to the tangent space of diffeomorphisms at the identity, and then you put on this set, on this tangent space, the metric, which is the one we just built. So the dot product with the V subscript. And you translate it then, using right translation in the group, to everywhere on the group of diffeomorphism, which gives this formula. So that defines the metric, the Riemannian metric on the group of diffeomorphisms. And from a more a computational point of view, this is the important part, the kinetic energy, which defines geodesics. Geodesics are local minimizers of this kinetic energy, the kinetic energy is directly defined in terms of the flow that can be used to generate diffeomorphism. The kinetic energy is just the integrated norm of the flow over time, where the diffeomorphism itself is it's the integral of the norm of the vector field integrated over time, where the vector field, where the flow itself is generated with this vector field. So that's mostly what I wanted to say in the global setting the space. I have defined, I would say, almost everything I wanted to describe. There's something I skipped here, is how you project from groups to spaces of deformable objects via the action. I won't be too specific about that, but I'll give a few more words when we go to, when I will talk about the geodesic equation. But before talking about geodesics and the EPDF equations, conservation of momentum, etc., there's one thing that we can do very naturally on the manifold, is minimizing function and computing gradient descent. So just in full generality, if I have a manifold M, the gradient of a function E is just defined by this formula, provided, of course, that this gradient exists. The gradient descent on the manifold is just solving this equation. And in fact, this simple concept gives very interesting evolutions when you apply it to diffeomorphism the way we built them. So the way we build diffeomorphism, this is what the definition of the gradient is. And if you revisit it a little bit, by replacing the delta phi by delta phi composed with phi inverse, you get this definition of the gradient. So this equation, given an energy E, defined on diffeomorphisms, this equation defines the gradient for the V measure. An important quantity here is this gradient phi composed with phi inverse, that denoted S of phi. And once you have S of phi, then that you identify using this equation, then the gradient descent equation becomes dt phi equals L minus S of phi composed with phi. And that's a very nice equation, because this is
again, a flow associated to NODE. And we know that under a reasonable condition, the flow associated to NODE provides a diffeomorphism. So it's really an evolutionary equation in groups of diffeomorphisms.
So I have several examples that I don't want to spend too much time on, but one very nice example is the one related to the Christensen algorithm on greedy image matching, which can be completely interpreted in the form of a gradient descent algorithm for a suitable metric associated to the Laplacian operator. You can make a little more of it and add regularization term to the same problem and get a new gradient descent algorithm. Don't ask me, I never tried it. You can try to do some segmentation. This is really work in progress, so I will just show you some preliminary results on that. But you can define a segmentation energy, which based on an initial template, try to find the best deformation of a template according to some function f, which locates the probability of, say, being in the interior of a shape we're looking for example. We're trying to segment out of the image. So if you have to, it's probably the simplest energy that you can build for segmentation. If you want to minimize this and work out the expression of S of phi, you get this quite simple expression for S of phi, and that gives you a gradient descent algorithm. You can do a little more than this and make add a feature, an initial feature that will restrict a little bit the evolution to ensure that you're not wiggling too much in the shape space, and restrict the evolution to be controlled by a finite number of control points, and restrict so the variation S to be some finite linear combination of some kernel K0 applied to the control points. K0 here is typically a kernel which is like K, but more rigid than K. So which creates more rigid variations. So you can work out what you need to do if you do that. The natural way is to take the original gradient, project it on the space on which you want your variation to be, and then you have some formula that you have to work out to get the exact expression of S, and I don't want to get too much into details here, but here are two examples that Felipe Arate has prepared. I say again, there are it's not two examples, the same example, but two different views. It's just to see that it's the hippocampal region. It's just to see that essentially the evolution is not really segmented the hippocampus in that case, but evolving in a way that creates a diffeomorphic deformation of the shape. Let me show you exactly what the shape does. Again, this is an animation due to Felipe. Why do you make the turn like that? It's just. But okay, that's going to stop. So just wait. The. So it's starting like that, and you see the evolution. There's really no singularity. Nothing bad happens to the triangulation of the time, and the thing grows to take its final position. Okay. No, it wasn't over. All right. Let's call it over. Another way of using gradient descent in diffeomorphisms is to try to minimize the area, so to generate some kind of area minimizing flow, and this is a collaboration with Saren Zeng, Jens Weck, and Tilak Ratnanathan. Here, there is a little variant here that I don't want to describe too much, but the metric is the same as before with some normalization which is related to some local measure of the area of the shape, of the surface. Sorry. And the goal is to, starting with an initial surface, minimize its area using this flow. So this is the expression of the flow. The only thing that I want to say is that when the kernel converges to something which is close to Dirac, this looks, this evolution would converge to the usual mean curvature flow. So here is just one example with using that flow. This is an original piece of cortex, and we I'm going to run this flow by letting the boundary of the surface fixed. And if you use the original mean curvature flow here, you get something that creates a lot of singularities, which means that the mean curvature flow, if you use, for example, a level set implementation for that, will change the topology of the surface, will create little blobs out of the surface. They will disappear after a while, but you may wonder whether or not you would have liked to keep these blobs if they were interesting in information or not. And this one here seemed to be considered as relevant, at least from what I was told, and you didn't want to make it go away completely. So so here it's just a mess over there. If you look at the triangulation, if you use the diffeomorphic flow, along the same period of time, you get this. You cannot see it very well, but there is no singularity there. It's a very nice triangulation that you get, and if you push, you probably don't want to. You're removing the information, but just to see what the flow gives. If you push it over time, you get a smooth surface here, except the boundary, which is fixed, so it's the same as before. So these are two examples of three with the one I skipped. So there are, let's say, a few examples of how to do grain descending groups of diffeomorphisms. Of course, you can use the Riemannian metric for more than that, and you can also compute geodesics in this group with the metric we have built. So, we're. These geodesic equations, in fact, in this kind of setting, which is, so the general abstract kind of setting is Lie group with the right invariant Riemannian metric, is something that has been, as far as I know, really introduced by Arnold in his work on the Euler equation for fluid mechanics in 66, although Marvin Reich and Ohm has found some hints of it being discovered by Poincaré, and since he's French, so
I noticed you don't even mention Euler.
Yeah, but Euler means, I don't think it's related to the Lie group thing. It's just because it's a variational. I mean, the Euler equation, and Poincaré came into it. So that's what you do. So is this define minimal a path of minimal energy in the group of diffeomorphism. Remember, I had defined the energy at the end of part one, and this was the integral of the norm of the velocity squared, where the velocity then build the flow, which is the so if you minimize this norm, you get a geode. So the geodesic equation has been called EPDIF, in fact, by Marvin Reich and Holm, and it's given in the classical form, it's given by this expression. And so this is an evolution equation. You want to consider it as an evolution equation in LV, in the momentum. So since V is L inverse LV, this is in fact an integral differential equation in the momentum. And then when you have V, you get the diffeomorphism by retrieving the flow associated to V. There are other forms of the equation. This is a non-classical one, the one which is generalized, which applies to singular solutions too. And going back to the other one, I just want to write this form to see. So V is some function of some A process where A is defined by this A, the momentum, and phi is given by this expression. I want to keep this because all the geodesic equations that we have later will be put in under this form. So it's V, so I have A, V, and phi, so three objects, three equations, and this kind of evolution. And here you want to notice that the right-hand side are linear in A and V, but not necessarily in phi. Okay, so one of the important byproduct, at least for us, of EPDIF is that it gave us, well, we have an extra person in the audience. So it gives us a way to represent diffeomorphisms related to one single template. In the tangent space of one single template, this is what we have called the momentum representation, because LV0 can be interpreted as momentum. And so this is mostly what Michael has described. Given a template, you can describe variations of this template by the initial condition of the geodesic equation that would start of its template. These initial conditions are completely captured by the initial velocity, or if you apply L to it, by the initial momentum. So this is the representation given the initial momentum. You solve EPDIF and you get a diffeomorphism. So this, just as an illustration, this is what the momentum can look like when you have image data. Again, as Michael has remarked, this momentum is some image that is drawn on the surface, and at least can be represented as such. And this thing here represents the variation going from this shape to this one, this being the template. And you can see that it is, I mean, the geometry is the same in these two images. And this completely encodes the new shape here with respect to that one. Another remark is when you solve LDDM and the LDDM problem, which is which general expression is this one, so the you minimize an expression of this form, then the deformed template is can also directly be represented by the initial momentum. More precisely, when you solve the LDDM problem, you get an initial momentum that completely describes the deformed template. Okay, so this is where we reach the issue of going from diffeomorphisms to deformable objects, to shapes. And so I don't want to be overly technical here, but in addition to the issue of solving geodesics, you have another feature which is important when you project a metric like we do, is the notion of horizontality, which say that if you deform a shape, let's say you deform an image, not all momenta are relevant. The ones that are important for deforming an image are the momenta that are so-called horizontal with respect to this image, which means that they are, in some sense, optimal to generate deformation. And I want to say much more than that. But, for example, for image, this is where you retrieve essentially the fact that the momentum has to be orthogonal to the level sets of the image. So the EPDIF equation, so once you restrict to horizontal initial conditions, you're done, because then you just use all the EPDIF equation to solve the geodesic in shape space, and that's what
this slide is about.
What the next three slides will show
is what happens when you do that on the three examples of deformable objects that I want to consider. And the first one is landmark. So you just deform endpoints. And you get this equation, which is just an ordinary differential equation with respect to x, v, and alpha. In fact, if you replace v by its expression, it's an ODE in x and alpha. And that generates geodesics. The x that you get are geodesics in the space of landmarks for the projected metric that we have used. Here are the equation for images, and this is the same equation. Doesn't look like it, but this is really the same equation. Both of them are instances of EPDIF for specific initial condition, and this is the one you get with density. So the densities, you can see that the role of M and A in the equations are somehow reversed. And again, this is the same equation. This evolution equation in diffeomorphism has really this nice feature of having some very different expressions, but at the end having the same being the same mathematical object in some sense. And it's a nice equation. If you put enough regularity in K, this equation has solutions. I mean, the three equations that I have described have solutions for arbitrary time. In fact, there are nice ordinary differential equations in a high dimensional space, or infinite dimensional space. So they're really very, very nice. I mean, the proof existence, you just use the Cauchy-Lipschitz theorem for that. So this is what I remarked when I talk about the first geodesic equation. They all can be put, and if you look at, well, say the previous one, they all can be put as V being a function of A and M, dmdt being a function of M and V, and dadt being a function of A and V, as full generality of M, A, and V, and all these functions of linear on A and V, and that. Well, they are what they are with respect to M. And so I will use this form later. A is an important feature in this equation because it encodes the momentum, in fact. So if you go back to this equation, just trust me on that, A always has the same dimension as the object that are deformed. So they are, at least from this point of view, they are a kind of as parsimonious as possible representation of the variation of the object. So once you have geodesics, there is another set of equation that is useful. It is the equation that corresponds to parallel translation. And so Michael has given some motivation. The real interest of parallel translation is that for many data sets, it's natural to compute variations of shape not with respect to one single template, as the momentum representation suggested to do, but with respect to templates which are adapted to a specific subpopulation of the data. And that can apply for asymmetry studies or more general group studies in which you have small groups and you want to have a template adapted to the group and you have several groups. And it can be adapted also, used also with time series, as Michael suggested. And so you want to have this relative shape information within the group. But at the end, you want to compare the groups with each other. And so you have to move all this within group information to one given place in which you can make comparison. And that's where parallel translation works. So parallel translation, the use of parallel translation is you're given momentum, essentially, with respect to one template. So we have some kind of local momentum representation. And you have this other template in which everybody wants to go at the end. So you have this momentum representation there.
The problem is to move this momentum representation from where it is to the template, because all the other subjects will go there, and there you will be able to make comparison. So first, the equation is, so if you're stuck with something on this form, this is the equation.
Well, we don't want
to comment on that. The only thing I want to comment on is this. So, well, what is important? Well, you have to say what's important. The important thing is BT. BT is what you're looking for. It's the evolution of the momentum from where, from the local expression to the final one. So B0, what was the local momentum? If you solve this equation, B1 will be your translated momentum. And this will go where you can make comparison. The BT here, at least dBt dt, the variation of BT is only defined implicitly here through h of m comma f of m comma dtb. This is a linear equation, because remember we assumed that h was and f were linear with respect to the second variable, but still have to be inverted to solve the problem, and that's a kind of tricky step in solving the power translation equation, especially when B is, like with images, infinite dimensional. So here is the expression, how the expression simplifies with diffeomorphisms. This expression, there is an expression for landmarks. There is an expression, so this is an expression for landmarks, and if you solve the power translation problem, this is what you get. So here is the context. You have, this would be my template. And I have a shape, let's call that the local template. And I have a shape in the same group as a local template. And I want to understand how the variation of the second shape relates to the initial template, but I want to understand this in a place in which I will be able to make comparison with other templates. So I want to move this information, the relative information, how this relates to this. I want to move somewhere else. I want to move it to there. That's another template, my kind of central template where everybody will go at the end. And so what I did here to compute this is to compute the momentum representation from this shape to this one, and then parallel translate it from this one to this one. What you see here is that the momentum is a Jacobian of the deformation that has been translated. And here is the resulting deformed shape for the parallel translated deformation, because once I parallel translate the Jacobian, when I parallel translate the momentum, then I can recreate a new deformation with the momentum representation. So this is what you get. You can see that the Jacobian has similar patterns, so that has been, the variation has been reasonably translated, and somehow the relation between these two shapes is similar to the relation between these two shapes. Here is another example to see what happens. You can see, for example, that this shape here is thinner than this one, and the same happens here. So you have equations for images. Let me skip that. You have equations for densities. And you always have this kind of nested term here that you have to solve to get B. The what I said for EPDIF and their variances shape is not true for parallel translation. When you project the geodesic equation, you essentially get the same equations with some kind of specific initial condition. When you do it with parallel translation, well, it's not exactly the same. So the only thing is that so this characterizes the relation between parallel translation and shape space and parallel translation, the original parallel translation in group of diffeomorphism. Okay, I think I'm reaching the end of my time. there's one last set of equations, which is the Jacobi equation, which just computes, the definition is very simple, it's variation of the geodesic. The Jacobi equation can be, oh, well, before that, I would say one of the important aspects of parallel translation is that it preserves the metric. And so it's an important feature in what we do, because we use a lot this metric, the norm of the momentum, etc. We do PCA, so we compute correlations. So it's important to preserve this when we move information. Okay, let me go back to the Jacobi equation. Jacobi equation is just the first variation of the geodesic equation. And one example of application, so there are a few of them. So once you want, I mean, you can write down LDVMM in terms of the initial momentum and minimize this respect to that, and the Jacobi equation comes. The equation for Jacobi fields, I should say, comes naturally there. It's also in June Mass tended estimation algorithm that Michael alluded to. I mean, in his talk, so we use it at several places. This is what the equation looks like. It doesn't matter that much. That was about June's algorithm, but Michael spent some time on that already. Okay, so that. As a conclusion, I think that this point of view of just looking at this time evolving equations is somehow at least complementary of the point of view that we may have, which is a variational point of view quite often, and minimizing a functional data. And these equations have really, all of them have had some practical application, and I believe that Elchi would show you some of them, especially with parallel translation, in her presentation. So they're interesting, and the good thing also is that they bring new open problems that have to be solved, especially numerical problems. I just alluded to this kind of inversion of a linear operator, which sometimes can be very ill conditioned. So they're already nice, nasty or nice, but depending on your position, numerical problems that have to be solved in this context. And thank you.
When you parallel transport the momenta, it stays horizontal to the target, right? I mean, it must be horizontal to the target.
Yes.
Okay.
Well, it's horizontal with the current position where it is.
Okay. Yeah.
And that's where the linear nasty thing comes in, because it's related to that. It's related to keeping it horizontal. Keeping it horizontal.
I think there was another question. So. Yeah.
In some places, you put in smoothing, in Gaussian smoothing, right? And how important is that? And does it change
it's fundamental. Gaussian
are types of smoothing. Does it?
No, it has to be a kernel that has a derivative, so it has to be a positive definite kernel. Gaussian is nice because it's easy to write down, but doesn't have to. It can be anything. If you take the inverse of the Laplacian operator, you get. An able kernel or a Laplacian kernel, and that works too, provided you have the polynomial terms that come in for us. There are other kernels that you can use in this context.
Other questions? There was Anuj Srivastava's student who's now a faculty or a postdoc here. Is he here still? Anyway, he asked me, before, what are some open problems in diffeomorphisms? And I said everything's open. But let me just take a quick one here. So the first thing that Laurent just showed about gradients and shape space, what it really is active shapes, active contours, but through diffeomorphisms. So nothing's been done yet on that. I know 30 years of active whatever, but just imagine that we want to sort of locally move, we want to do active contours in that case, but we want to guarantee that every time I move, I stay and move through shape space and change if you want them. So there's got to be every single thing that's been done in active. I'm going to keep jump diffusing mitochondria going again. I mean, it's So that would be a good, there's got to be things there, right? Is anybody actively working that sort of at CIS now?
Actively working? Because Felipe is working on that, but.
So, I don't know. Let's have some fun with it over the next 10 years. Recreate activity.
Yeah, we have
that. I'll be doing jump diffusions. So, thanks, Laurent. Why don't we take a 10